can't see me way over here, Uncle Ben.
If you're not over 20 feet away, it can't. Let's see. Yep, it sees you, but it's weak. That's how I can tell if you're near or far away, by the strength of the signal.
Golly, that's just like radar, Uncle Ben.
It is, son. It's blind man's radar.
The National Broadcasting Company presents The National Hour. This is a mirror of public opinion, reflecting what America and the world are thinking, planning, and doing. This is today's interpretation of the problems and the newsworthy milestones that we must reach and pass on the road to peace and reconstruction. Today, March 31st, 1946, we present the 20th in the distinguished new NBC series, The National Hour. Our subject for today:
the United States Army, Operation Peacetime.
This is Robert St. John in New York. Victory has come to us. The years of grim struggle are all over. Our citizen army, built from scratch into the world's greatest fighting machine, has finished its biggest job. The story of its great battle, fought in mud and tropic heat on a dozen fronts, is recorded for all time. Its great military achievements are known to all of us. We'll be hearing a great deal of these achievements between now and Saturday, which is Army Day. Not so well publicized are the non-military accomplishments of the Army, the inventions and techniques developed by the Army to meet its own special needs, the sinews of war that will someday enrich our peacetime living. These we propose to examine today.
This is Robert McCormick in Washington. We shall also look at some of the peacetime non-military projects of the Army, projects that have helped this country grow and flourish, projects developed by the Army in peacetime for peacetime living. And finally, we shall look ahead to the future of our peacetime Army. And here with me today to tell of his hopes for that Army and for the future of this country is Secretary of War Robert P. Patterson. We are standing by.
What does a peacetime Army do? Well, the Constitution of the United States gives the exact definition of its duty.
We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare.
Provide for the common defense. That is the Army's first and most important job, defense of the realm. In peace, it must stand ready for attack from without. It must prevent civil strife from within. But during peacetime, it has a duty other than defense, a duty also found in the Constitution, a duty to promote the general welfare. The Army has done this, too, in many ways and for many years. Even as far back as 1798, it was contributing to the advancement of our national life. You might almost say it started one day of that year in the Secretary of War's office.
There's someone outside to see you, Mr. Secretary.
Who is it?
He didn't say, sir. Just said it was urgent. He's carrying a mighty strange-looking satchel, sir.
Not so very strange, my good man. Who owns this satchel has wealth beyond reason.
And who are you, sir?
Eli Whitney's the name, Mr. Secretary.
Whitney? Oh, the gunsmith?
Eli Whitney, inventor of the cotton gin and sundry other devices, is a more likely description, sir.
Oh, yes, yes. You have a contract with the War Department to deliver muskets, I believe.
Aye. But first, I'd like to show you the contents of this satchel.
What is the meaning of this, dumping this rubbish on my desk?
Well, not rubbish, Mr. Secretary. These things are invaluable. They're the metal parts for two of your muskets.
Well, I see two musket barrels and a handful of metal junk. Where are the muskets?
There's two complete muskets right here, sir. All we have to do is put them together. Here, like this. The firing device attaches up here with a guard over the top of it, you see?
Well, yes, yes, but look here, Whitney. I want muskets brought to me finished, all in one piece.
Well, that's no good, sir. Suppose a trigger breaks on that kind of musket. What do you have to do?
We'll get another made, naturally.
Aye, made to fit just that rifle, and that takes time. Look, I can take this trigger off. There.
Say, they both fit.
Yes, that's my idea, sir. Interchangeable parts.
What's the trouble? Trigger break? You can get that fixed, son. Buy a new trigger. Cost you no more than a shilling. And that's the best thing about these interchangeable.
Hurry up! Hurry up there! Get your wagons in line. Pickets getting ready to charge. You with a busted wheel. Don't just stand there. Take one off this wagon that's wrecked. Sure, they're all the same size. Come on, get your wagons in line. Get your wagons.
I'll get a new one, man. We can't keep our drill press out of use just for a crack flange. Here, take down this number. A4317, left. Now run up to the stockroom, give them that number, and they'll give you a new flange. We'll get this press running inside of 10 minutes.
Yes, that peacetime Army contract laid the groundwork for our present-day production methods for mass production, which could not exist without its interchangeable parts. And mass production has given us the highest living standard anywhere in the world.
War Department files here show that time and again our peacetime Army has led the way to new techniques, new expansion of our national life. Under the direction of Captain Meriwether Lewis and William Clark, an Army expedition left St. Louis in 1804 to explore the land between there and the Pacific Ocean.
I beg to report, sir, that much of the land is of an arable nature and abounds in great beauty, especially in the lowlands. Water and game are plentiful, and such supplies of timber as I have never before encountered.
Yes, the Army expedition under Lewis and Clark opened the floodgates of expansion to the vast region lying between the Mississippi and the Pacific coast. It made possible the physical America, which we all know today.
And here's another Army milestone. In 1900, the island of Cuba was one vast pest hole of yellow fever. American troops stationed there caught it and died by the score. Army doctors were helpless. They could not find out how the disease was transmitted.
But, Dr. Reed, this is ridiculous. A mosquito cannot carry yellow fever. We have always had mosquitoes in Cuba.
And you've always had yellow fever.
Mosquitoes. You will be laughed out of the Army if you persist in this folly.
What happens to one man isn't important when hundreds are dying.
Major Walter Reed, peacetime soldier, did persist, and finally he proved that yellow fever was caused by the bite of an infected mosquito. Control of the carrier mosquito eliminated the disease. It was this dread fever that years before had foiled the French in their attempt to build a canal across the Isthmus of Panama. After the threat of disease was removed, American Army engineers went to work, but the Panama Canal, as it stands today, is almost as great a monument to Dr. Reed as it is to the Army engineers who built it.
And Washington records show that as the Western Plains were settled and America began to spread, new problems came up. Control of the Indians, forest fires, and floods, there were only a few of the problems faced by our peacetime Army. Much of its work, however, was in pioneering new fields of endeavor in ventures too large for individual effort. For example, the Army in peacetime built
the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad, the Erie, the New Haven,
the Bonneville Dam, bringing needed irrigation and electric power to the Northwest.
Levees and spill reservoirs along the Mississippi to keep the flood currents within the riverbanks.
Engineering projects of enormous value to the nation's prosperity. The work of a peacetime Army.
Yes, our peacetime army has been a guiding hand in the building of America, speeding up our schedule of expansion and creative growth. But the army in wartime has brought forth its quota of new ideas, too. For war, well, looking at it one way, war is like a hothouse. It forces quick growth of new inventions and techniques. Under the pressure of our last war, the Army developed many things to meet its own special needs. Now, in peacetime, most of them will be passed on to the public.
One of these new developments is quite an interesting little item. Small, but it can be very useful at times, a waterproof match. During the war, while traveling around our Pacific bases, I often heard of this special match, but was never able to find one. So I had to wait until I returned to Washington. Now the War Department has very kindly given me one. I've had it soaking here in a glass of water since the program began. Now let's see if this waterproof match really works. Ow! It works.
That's one, and there are many other new things produced by the Army which the public will like, too. All right, Oscar, start your pitch.
Hi, step right up, folks. Take a look at this magnificent collection. Keep away there, lad. The elephant will bite you. Now, folks, rest your orbs on this object. Very useful. A bar of all-purpose soap. Makes a fine lather in hard salt or average water and good for anything from washing clothes to shaving. And here's something to dazzle your eyes. A one-pound stove. Think of that. You can carry it in a side pocket. Ideal for vacation campers. Here we have it, here we have it. Gaze at this bit of gossamer material, my friends. No Lovelace should be without it. What is it? Plastic netting, non-rusting, inexpensive, excellent for house screens. Ah, but here's something you'll really go for. Synthetic rubber shoe soles. Outlast leather 3-to-1. They have a special built-in feature, too. Listen. That's the way leather sounds. Now here's the synthetic rubber sole in action. Listen. That's the new feature, silence. Detectives and gentlemen who come home late will especially appreciate this feature.
Thank you, Oscar. But here's one of the most useful of the devices developed for wartime operation, now available in Operation Peacetime, the walkie-talkie radio. Range up to 5 miles, very useful on the farm, especially to the farmer's wife.
Susie to Lem, Susie to Lem, come in, Lem. Is that you, Lem? Well, it could be someone else, couldn't it? All right, that's enough of that. It's time for dinner. Are you done plowing the South 40? Not yet. Well, what have you been doing all morning? Fixing your aerial? A bird flew into it? Oh!
One of the strangest and least known wartime projects now under development is the optical cane. Not a cane at all, really, but a small object about the size of a lunchbox. Small enough for a man to carry easily.
Uncle Ben, why don't you take Lassie with you anymore when you go out for a walk?
I don't need a dog for a seeing eye now, Billy. I have this little box.
How can you see with just a little old box?
I don't. The box has the eyes. See those two lenses in front of it, where I have my hand?
Uh-huh.
Well, a beam of light shoots out of the top one, and when it hits something like, say, a piece of furniture, it bounces right back into the other lens, see?
And it goes right back in the box?
Yes. I'll show you how it works. Look, I'll turn around 2 or 3 times, so I won't know what direction I'm facing or where the furniture is. There. And I turned around. Now I'll walk forward.
What's that noise, Uncle Ben?
Why, that's my warning signal. Isn't there a piece of furniture or something over there?
Oh, there's nothing over here.
Nothing? Well, where are you?
Right here.
Then it's you. The light beam is bouncing back from you.
From me?
Yes. That's how I keep from walking into people on the street.
Oh, but how bucket of light make a noise?
Well, I don't rightly know. It does something to a photoelectric cell inside the box.
Can it see me way over here, too?
Well, if you're not over 20 feet away, it can. Let's see. Yep, it sees you, but it's weak. That's how I can tell if you're near or far away, by the strength of the signal.
Golly, that's just like radar, Uncle Ben.
It is, son. It's blind man's radar.
And that is how a new science may, in time, help the sightless. But electronics will serve in other roles, too. In weather forecasting, for example, a whole new branch of meteorology called spherics has been created by the Signal Corps. The device on which this new branch of science depends is the new static direction finder, or, as most people would call it, the storm finder.
The use of the static direction finder is made possible by the fact that most storms and cloud masses contain static electricity. The direction finder picks up the static impulse from the storm area by means of a directional antenna. Aside from its great accuracy, the static direction finder enables us to look further into the weather than ever before.
But the real glamour girl of the war was radar, or to use her full title, radio detecting and ranging. Radar has an almost uncanny ability to detect airplanes in flight when they're still as much as 150 miles away. Here now is how it works.
Radar sends high-frequency radio waves into the sky for the same reason a hunting dog is sent into a forest. Both are looking for game. As far as radar is concerned, any object it touches is game because it reflects the wave back to where it came from. And since the speed of radio waves is known, the distance from the object can be calculated from the length of time it takes a wave to get there and back.
And that is radar in a nutshell. One day here at NBC, we heard the news of a thrilling development in this field.
The date, January the 10th, 1946.
The place, Evans Signal Laboratory, Belmar, New Jersey.
The time, 11:48 a.m., the time of the rising moon.
Transmitting conditions, excellent.
The project, to establish contact with a celestial body.
As far as I can see, everything is in order.
Good. Let's begin.
Very well.
Aim antenna.
Antenna sighted an object.
Check direction.
Direction accurate.
Transmit. We did it, Doc. We did it. That second buzz was our wave reflected back from the moon.
We've hit the moon. Well, it ought to be more dramatic than that little pipsqueak tone.
Oh, well, come on now. Don't get that way. This is a big thing. We should celebrate.
Yes, very well. Oh, John, bring my coffee over here, will you?
Yes, sir, just a second.
And as long as we're celebrating, put an extra lump of sugar in it.
But even if Dr. Webb wasn't very excited, the rest of the world was, particularly the scientists. For it proved to them something they had long suspected, that radio could penetrate the ionosphere. This great envelope of electrically charged ether that surrounds the Earth above the stratosphere has long stood like a sentinel guarding outer space. And now at last it had been pierced, and at least one fantastic dream, that of flying radio-controlled spaceships in the void above the Earth, had been brought a little closer.
Perhaps the most spectacular development to come out of this war, to add its share to our peacetime commerce, is the jet-propelled plane.
But the Army has still another iron in the fire, and a very hot one, too. The wartime-developed rocket. So far, rockets have been used only as projectiles to carry explosives. Already, the idea of spaceships, or enlarged rockets, cruising thousands of miles above the Earth, has captured the public's imagination. And someday that may happen. But what of the Army in the days ahead, in operation, peacetime? What will be its course? What will be its need?
The Army needs men.
Carpenters.
Auto mechanics.
Draftsmen. Clerks.
X-ray operators.
For the new, complex equipment, the Army needs skilled men more than ever before. To fill this need, it trains its own men, in many cases giving them better instructions than they could get in their own communities.
And here's another aspect of the Army's future, one that's causing some trouble right now. In Europe, hungry GIs sometimes found a small sign displayed at the better restaurants. It said,
"For officers only."
Or some citizen soldier may have overheard a conversation like this between a certain Colonel Blimp and his little daughter.
"Look at that, Ruthie. Isn't that a beautiful sunset?"
"Oh, yes, it's lovely. But, Daddy..."
"Yes?"
"Isn't there another one somewhere? A littler one?"
"Another sunset? Of course not."
"But don't the enlisted men have one, too?"
Sharp social lines do exist between officers and men in the Army. Officers call them a tradition. GIs call them the caste system. One of the reasons for this friction lies in the high-quality training now given enlisted men. The development of complex equipment in this war has required a level of training far beyond that of any previous war. In effect, this training has given many enlisted men officer quality without securing them a commission. And so there have been complaints. But an Army board comprising both enlisted men and officers has been appointed to look into the problem. It's expected by some that rigid social lines are due for a fall.
Today, our peacetime Army stands at about 2.5 million men. It plans to shrink itself to a mere 1,070,000 by July 1st, 1947. It also is studying how to unify itself with the other services if the proposal for unification of the armed forces is adopted.
But new problems arising out of the dislocations of war have to be solved, too. Occupation of enemy territory is one of them, the most immediate one. In both Germany and Japan, the Army is working to get industry started, to care for displaced persons, and to punish the war makers. No one knows how long we shall have to do this, for so much depends upon the conquered people themselves.
Those are some of the responsibilities and achievements of our peacetime Army. But for a more complete picture, we must call on someone who is actually helping to put that picture together. Here with me at the National Hour microphone in Washington is the man who can best tell that story, Secretary of War Robert P. Patterson.
You've just heard a stirring record of our Army and its peacetime contribution to a fuller American life. I want to talk to you now about the Army's biggest job today. A job in Japan and in Germany. What our men do in these two critical areas, today and tomorrow and in the days that lie ahead, will determine whether the peace our soldiers so gallantly fought for can be maintained. It is not a new job. It is to finish the job that we were forced to undertake on December 7, 1941. We have compelled our enemies to lay down their arms. Now we must not only destroy the arms themselves, but make it impossible for these people to build munitions again and renew the fighting. The occupation job is difficult. The job has its problems. Great progress has been made. There is much yet to do, and our soldiers serving in these occupied countries are making history, just as their brothers did on the beachheads of Normandy and in the jungles of New Guinea. Their work is less spectacular, but their contribution toward the creation and maintenance of peace is equally commendable and may prove equally historic. Men are volunteering by the thousands to fill our ranks in the occupied areas, but we need more. We are making every effort to get more. Today, we have in Germany not more than 350,000 men. And they are governing 17 million Germans. In Japan, we have 200,000. And they are in control of 70 million Japanese. In numbers, there is no comparison. But in responsibility, the situation makes every one of our soldiers a vital representative of our country, whose everyday conduct is taken as that of the American people. It is a grave responsibility, and it is being carried out with skill and dignity. It is a challenge to young Americans everywhere to join this useful army and to promote the peace and welfare of our country for years to come. The American soldier today, at home and abroad, is the United States people working for the greatest goal we have ever set. He has earned your respect and affection. He deserves your unstinted loyalty and support. The American soldier has always been the member of an honorable profession, performing an essential duty of citizenship. Today, in every part of the world, he represents the American way of life and is the symbol of American power. He works for the attainment of a world in which all men can live without fear. No higher duty has ever been assigned a citizen of any country.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary.
The United States Army has been the subject of our documentary, and this is what we have learned.
At the peacetime, non-military contributions of the Army to this country's development began in colonial times and have continued to the present day, in many cases providing services that could not be obtained from any other source. But the recent wartime Army inventions and techniques will find wide application in industry and in our civilian life. But the occupation of conquered countries is the greatest job which lies ahead for our peacetime army.
On the subject of the United States Army, Operation Peacetime, then, our documentary is closed.
Not quite closed, if you don't mind, and if you don't mind eavesdropping a bit.
If I ever catch you guys doing that stuff again, I'll grind the flesh right off your bones. And I'm not kidding.
Just a minute, Corporal. Just a minute. Now, I'll take it easy.
But, Sergeant,
You listen to me. You gotta respect these guys, see?
But look, Sergeant.
These ain't the old days, Corporal. The Army's different now. You gotta be a gentleman. Every dogface is a potential general.
I know that, Sergeant,
but. You can't yell at these men. They ain't dogs. You gotta be gentle. Like a kitten almost. Now, Corporal, what's the trouble?
Oh, it wasn't much, Sarge. They were only sewing the cuffs of a guy's pants together.
So what? That's nothing. Let him go.
Okay. Okay, gentlemen, put the sergeant's pants back.
My pants? Why, you dirty little sneak. Sewing my pants together, huh? I'll put you bums on KP for the rest of your life. And if I ever catch you again, I'll grind every your skirt right under. Get out.
This is Robert St. John inviting you to listen to the National Hour again next Sunday, when our subject will be the return of sports.
This has been the National Hour. From our studios in New York and Washington, the National Broadcasting Company has presented the 20th of the new series on current affairs and national problems. Our speaker today was the United States Secretary of War, Robert P. Patterson. Robert St. John was your narrator, with Robert McCormick reporting from Washington. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.